Jerry Pippin, and here we are, of course, in Eureka Springs, Arkansas again. Wendell Stevens, always good to see you. We've done a lot of shows from Eureka Springs.
Yes, you sure have.
You didn't have any trouble getting here, huh?
No, I didn't have any trouble. I had a Continental Airlines ticket. American passengers did have trouble, though.
Well, you're an old pilot, and I mean that respectfully. I didn't quite understand that wire.
I couldn't see where there was a real safety hazard, because the problem was the spacing on the straps that hold the bundles of wire together should have been 4 inches apart, and it was 6 inches apart. So they clipped them all off and put 4-inch binds on, bending on all those bundles of wire. That was the safety problem.
So looks like somebody was exerting their power here. I guess we'll leave it at that. You talked about Billy Meyer again here.
Yes.
Anything new there? I know Mike Horn has a new DVD out about it.
Yes, he does. It's a nice DVD. It's well done. It's got a lot of images of Billy Meyer when he was a younger man that I never had before.
Now, you when you met him, how old was he?
Well, I think he looked like he was in his middle 30s when I first met him. Yes, and he's up in his middle 60s now.
And so, and how many times you've been over there?
I went over there 11 times, and I spent...
Yeah, I knew it was a lot.
Yeah. All at my expense, my own money, too. And I stayed anywhere from a week to 2 weeks each time in his household, living in a room upstairs, right with his family, watching everything going on. I worked with him, hauling manure for their gardens and picking rocks out of the gardens and helping them grade the road and things like that to be useful while I was there.
Well, you know, we have a couple of interviews with you on our website that people can find and listen to, in which you talked in great detail about some of your experiences with Billy Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought if it'd be okay with you, we might talk to you about a few of these other things happening. What else has piqued your interest these days?
Well,
you're always writing, and as you explained to me one time, it's not exactly like a book, but it is a book. It's more like an Air Force report.
It's a report, like a journalistic report, or like a military report. I'm used to writing military reports, and I write like that, just like a journalistic report of events as they happen. I'm not a writer. I don't write with an introduction, a build-up, a climax, and a close. That's how books are written. I write the events as they happen, with all the data in the event. It's like a journalistic, like you read in a newspaper. The surprises come wherever they happen during the investigation.
What have you been investigating recently? You've been doing a lot of traveling, making appearances at conferences. Maybe you haven't had time to investigate any.
Well, I haven't had much time to do a lot of investigating. I went to Argentina at their invitation just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, really?
And they had a conference scheduled at Rosario, which is about 80 kilometers from Buenos Aires. When we got to Buenos Aires, though, we found that huge produce trucks, were blocking all the roads out of the city because the new woman president had increased the tax on produce 50%. And the truckers weren't going to accept it, and in protest, they used their big trucks and blocked all the roads so nobody could get in or out of Buenos Aires. Until she went on the radio and agreed to moderate it a bit, she cut the 50% down to 25%. They moved the trucks that night, but the next morning they're back again. They had another meeting and decided that wasn't enough.
Well,
we never did get out of Buenos Aires. So what we did is went down to Pedro Romniak's house. Pedro Romniak is the Heineck of South America.
Uh-huh.
We went out to his little house on the outskirts of Buenos Aires, where we had a mini meeting of about 50 or 60 people that he got together on quick notice and did a presentation anyway. You know, I have been wanting to meet Pedro Romniak all my life. He was one of the prime contactees of the Umites when they were coming into Spain. They would contact the Spanish scientists by letter, using a public stenographer to write their letters, and they put the seal on it, and the stenographer would mail it. So they wrote a letter to Pedro Romniak in Argentina, but in the letter to Pedro Romniak, they sent a photograph of their ship, an Umite photograph. The Umite pictures are different from our technology. Their flat two-dimensional picture is perfect three-dimensional. The emulsion is made up of little discs of reflective material that scattered all through the emulsion in such a way that when you look at the picture, you can move your head and look behind.
You hold a snapshot and you move it around.
Has depth, like looking in a box.
Wow.
And I wanted to see that, and his room is, house is like mine. He's got stuff piled everywhere. We couldn't find it.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. I'd love to have seen it.
But they literally wrote him a letter, huh?
They wrote him several letters, which you might see along. He had the originals. He sent me a copy of one of the originals way back when he was having these contacts.
And where does that stand at this day? Do people?
The Umites are still in contact with Spanish scientists. They have not. They have 18 other missions around the world, and we don't hear anything of the other missions. They're in strange countries like Zimbabwe and Bolivia, Argentina, Australia, outback.
I wonder why they chose those third world countries for.
Well, they had a base in Germany and Denmark and Yugoslavia, England also, mm-hmm. and it was two in the United States. So they are in first world countries. But they, when they discovered us way back in 1949, they became so interested in Earth phenomena because of the extreme variety we have in all species and types and classes of all living things. And they say that this peculiar variety comes from a particularly harsh sun and a reduced attenuation. When the flood came down, it cleared the skies. We saw it for the first time. It also allowed sharper radiation to come through from the sun. And it caused all lifespans to be decreased to 10%. Remember, all Earth lifespans before Moses were 1,000 years.
In the Bible.
And after the flood,
Methuselah.
He lived 1,009 years. Uh-huh. After the flood, all lifespans of all things on the planet were reduced to 10%. So we have short lifespans, a harsh sun causing rapid mutation, and we become the laboratory rats for all the other species. They come here to view mutation in progress.
Any chance that our lifespan is going to extend back to what it was, or is the sun just powerful?
It's too powerful. If we could figure a way to do the shielding, like building domes over the whole cities, then we might be able to increase the lifespans of the people who live under the domes. But I don't see any progress in that direction.
When we talk about Brazil, I know you've been down there several times.
Mm-hmm.
You don't speak Portuguese, do you?
No, but I translate it.
Do you? How do you do that?
Well, I can read it, but I can't pronounce it.
Understand.
It's Spanish with a kind of a French accent on it that's hard for my tongue.
But you can read it?
I read it, yes.
Yeah. How many times have you been to Brazil? Five or six?
Maybe a dozen or more.
Oh, more than that, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I know we've talked about some pretty interesting things that have happened in Brazil over the years in our programs. Brazil seems to be an interesting place for UFO ET contact. Why?
Well, probably because of the size of it. Brazil is bigger than the whole United States, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
It has the dense jungles that were very remote and difficult to get to. So there was a lot of Brazil that remained unexplored for a long time. And are you familiar with the Adrien case in Miami, Florida?
No, tell me about that.
He was being contacted by what he said were Pleiadian humans that took him to an underground base in the southwest highlands of Brazil where those alien extraterrestrials were working in harmony with two other different race types in their underground facility. And he was taking
race types from other worlds.
Three different worlds
mm-hmm.
working in harmony in an underground
base.
What
were the other two race types? Sure.
Well, one was a gray species, and the other one was another human species.
Okay.
And they were getting along very well, and they had ships from all three of the societies in the underground hangars there. And way back in the 30s, a German explorer by the name of Brugger discovered the aliens there. He was exploring in the region, studying the wild natives that lived there. And somebody mentioned that there was Americans upstream. They took him up to meet the Americans. They turned out to be the extraterrestrial humans, and they were at that time they were worried about the destruction of the forests in Brazil and encroaching civilization on their society, and I'm afraid they would be discovered and driven out. And they asked this German explorer if he could do anything for them, and when he got home after that to Germany, he told the Germans that he wrote a book about his trip in Brazil, and word got to Goering, and he had told the aliens in Brazil that he would see what he could do about getting them some help to stop the encroachment of civilization on their area. So he told Goering about it, and Goering sent 2,000 German soldiers up into that area of Brazil. He sent them to the east coast of Brazil in submarines. They went by a submarine ashore on rubber dinghies, and then hired taxis and things to get to a river port, and bought steamer tickets up the river as far as they could go, where the native tribes would take over and forward them right into where the aliens were. So the 2,000 German soldiers got to the alien facility, where they set up a defense perimeter inside of the aboriginals. And they married Indian women. They were all single German soldiers. They married Indian women, raised families, and the offspring of those families grew up going to school, the local schools run by the alien visitors. So they grew up being educated in alien technology. And the young German pilots now in their low 20s, by the time Adrienne was taken down there, they were young pilots, German pilots from those families had been raised in their schools, were working with those extraterrestrials and flying their vehicles. So Adrienne...
You're talking about flying the ET?
They were flying the ET discs, flying discs. Mm-hmm. And the Germans had even built the versions of the flying discs themselves, so they had German versions that were being flown by German pilots, and German pilots flying some of the alien extraterrestrial vehicles. And when Adrienne and his living girlfriend were taken down there, they're still using a little plastic Polaroid camera. She took pictures of Adrienne with his back to the camera, and one of the German pilots standing beside him watching three craft landing on little platforms, landing platforms down there in the jungle area. And I tried to get copies of those pictures. I was never allowed to possess it.
Was this after World War II or before?
It was after World War II.
I know we talked about the Nazi influence in the ETs one time, you and I did. And you said you ran across some pretty interesting papers in Wright-Patterson. It was Patterson Field back then.
I had them shredded and burned because I didn't know what they were. And later I found out that one of them was a map of the 9 Kugelblitz bases in the greater Germany that was very important to UFO research, but I didn't know it at the time because it was not in the need-to-know loop. And I shredded them and burned them.
So you think the German government today officially knows a lot about ETs?
No. The German government...
did that happen? That they don't know now.
When the Germans were helped to build the flying discs way back during the war, the alien visitors that helped them had another motive. They thought that the reason humanity was so belligerent was because they weren't familiar enough with each other. Only the rich could travel by steamer or by airliner. And they thought if we could mix better, we could become more acquainted with each other, more familiar with each other, we would lose some of our belligerence. So they thought if they could give us an air transport that could be used very economically, it didn't require fuel, didn't require a big infrastructure out of town and everything like that, everybody could travel freely because costing practically nothing to do so. So they began helping the German engineers. There was a surplus of German engineers after World War I when we bombed out and destroyed their factories. Then they went in and built new factories with aid programs and new material supply lines. So now we had new factories, new lines, new production facilities, and a lot of surplus German engineers. So the Aldebaran visitors concluded this would be the ideal place to build the airliners of the future. And they actually started and got operational discs. And when they saw the Germans invert a tank turret on the bottom of one and fire it, they realized that they may be giving us a bigger and better weapon. They sabotaged the whole program and left.
So in other words, it's not a new story. It's an old story through time. Somebody tries to help somebody else, and somebody figures out how to weaponize it.
Yeah. So the German engineers, in a couple of years, they were able to work around the sabotage efforts and get the program going again. They actually built flying discs before the war ended. They had the first ones under test by 1941. By 1940, I think it was 44 when we began our carpet bombing of the Schweinfurt bearing plant and the Plasti oil fields. And we had a 800 bomber mission on one night going into Germany. I think that was to the Plasti oil fields. 800 bombers. That's a lot of bombers.
Yes, it is.
And that night, the Germans had 9 Hanabus operational. They only used 6 of them. They launched them that night against the carpet bombing fleet, and they brought down 1/4 of the fleet, 200 bombers in one night, and over 3,000 crewmen.
And you're talking about 4 or 6?
Only 6 Hanabus. Okay. And the Hanabus only had 2 weapons aboard.
Kind of weapons were these?
One of them was called a Motorstoppel. It was nothing more than a beam, an electromagnetic beam that interrupted ignition circuits, caused engines to fail. That was one weapon. The other weapon was nothing but aerosol cans filled with benzene. It was dropped ahead of the bomber fleet with the spray valve open, creating a cloud of vapor. When the bomber fleet flew into the cloud of vapor, they'd get a big explosion, would take out a dozen bombers at a time. And on the other hand, when they caused the ignitions to fail, they were flying in such close formation to get gun coverage all around the fleet that if an engine began to misfire and fail, it would back into the one behind it. And that would cause him to back into another, or if he turned away, he'd get the ones on the side.
As they flew in tight formations.
Yeah, so we lost 200 airplanes in one night. That's 1/4 of the fleet. We couldn't have continued the war at that rate. But
when you were in the Air Force, did you have an occasion to see any of those reports, what our version of that was? I wonder what we thought.
At that time, no. Yeah. No, I was not. I was out in the Pacific. Yeah, I was a fighter pilot in the Pacific.
I understand that. And you told me, I think, one time you really never really saw a UFO until you were flying in a private plane up towards Chicago someplace.
Yeah, right. I never saw a Foo Fighter or anything like that. I heard about them, but I never saw it.
Mm-hmm. So, but you have no doubt this probably happened with the Nazis.
I'm convinced that it happened, that it did happen, and they succeeded in getting operational. What baffles me is after that success, which was turning the tide of war, all of the Hanabus were ordered out of Germany. Within 10 days, they were gone and never returned, never came back. And then Germany collapsed, and the Germans
Germany at that point lost their ET support.
Well, either that or somebody else ordered the Hanabus out and wouldn't let them. Somebody else is controlling the progress of wars, and the winner is already calculated. They know who the winner is going to be, and that was changing the course of war, and they weren't going to allow it, whoever that is.
So are we talking about somebody else, like a new world order?
Bigger than governments. Bigger than national governments that ordered the Hanabus out of Germany to stop the changing of the progress of the war.
Have you done any, you've written, 80-some-odd books?
No, 31.
31?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're 85, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I got that part right.
Yeah.
31, that's still a lot of books. I'm not reading that at all. Have you ever done anything about the New World Order and maybe the influence?
No, I haven't.
What do you think of that?
Well, I mean,
we've never discussed this.
Yeah. I'm inclined to agree that we need a one-world government, that we're never going to enter the community of space travelers until we get a one-world government. Mm-hmm. Because as the situation stands now, if the aliens approach the American government, the Chinese and Russians wouldn't accept it. If they approach the Russians, the Chinese and Americans wouldn't. If they approach the Chinese and Russians, the Americans would not accept it. So we're not going to let anybody become the dominant power and control the world at the present stage of events, of affairs. And we have to get to a point where we do have somebody speaking for this planet. And then we can begin interplanetary commerce, which has never begun for us.
But you think it's out there?
I think it's there, waiting. I think we have to get to a one-world government in order to join the community of planets that are waiting and available.
So instead of T-shirts from China. We might have them from Alpha Centauri.
Yeah.
Interesting thought. We're talking with Wendell Stevens. I'm Jerry Pippin. We'll be right back.
Why visit the Grand Canyon in Arizona? Marv Mason knows why.
Mainly because the Grand Canyon is known as one of the seven natural wonders of the world.
No one gives a more personalized tour or knows more about the Grand Canyon than Marvelous Marv.
My main thing is education on the geology, because the Grand Canyon is a life record. It shows us where we were at one time on the planet with the continental drift and all the layers that were laid down by sediments, and then how the canyon was carved. And, of course, the views, you know, a picture doesn't do it justice. But it's nice to have somebody there tell you about it that's lived there.
It's the best way to tour the Grand Canyon. Marv picks you up in a modern van at your hotel in the Grand Canyon area and takes you on a day-long tour. Contact Marvelous Marv Vacation Tours. Call and talk to him personally. 928-707-0291. Or visit his website.
MarvelousMarv.com. Real easy, real easy.
It's Jerry Pippin, and we are at the end of the Ozarks in Eureka Springs, of course, at the Ozark UFO Conference. Wendell Stevens. Really, Wendell, I think I'd call you the dean of UFO researchers. There's other people like Bob Dean, and other people have been around, but 31 books, and you've been doing this now, what, 40 years, 50 years?
Yeah. Since 1947.
Well, we can add that up real fast.
60 years.
That's 61 years.
Yeah.
So anyway, who are you?
My name is John Smith.
And where are you from, John?
Timbuktu.
I don't know if he's really telling us the truth or not. Go ahead, John. You have a question for Wendell.
I came in a little late, so that you might have already covered this, but what were the name of the things that you said were withdrawn from Nazi Germany?
Hanabus. They called them Hanabus.
Hanabus. What are those? Were those?
They're a flying disc about 100 feet in diameter.
Okay.
That worked under free energy. They didn't require any fuel to fly. They had gravity control and could rise and descend vertically. They could hover in the air. They had a degree of invisibility when they were under power and the force field was produced around them.
Okay, this sounds similar to the fellow who was on coast the other night. I think his book is The Brotherhood of the Bell. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
What is his name? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
He's going to start working with Richard Hoagland. Their work has dovetailed, and they're going to start working together. But he's done research along these lines also.
So in other words, they had flying discs, the Nazis did.
Yes.
But these are different than that.
We may be talking about the same thing. The Nazi flying discs were bell-shaped. They were almost identical to the Adamski-type spacecraft.
And anyway, John, you got anything else?
I believe that'll do for now.
Okay. Thanks a lot for coming by. Wendell, when we talk about the Nazis and the New World Order, and then you're talking about really there's nobody on this planet that can speak for the planet, how do you envision this ever changing? We're pretty tribal, I guess.
I think it's very grim the way the situation lays right now. We're in a conflict we can't seem to get out of. I see our political situation deteriorating, personally. I am afraid that it may deteriorate to something that's even worse that we can't get out of. And I'm very afraid for where our society is.
Well, you one time told me, and I've forgotten how many species you thought there were around galaxies and interstellar space, but it was quite a few.
Yes. I think the variety of visitors is another example of the infinity of creation. There are no two exactly alike. And I get to this conclusion because of about 115 cases I'd looked in great detail, studied them for years, and only two of those might have been coming from the same place, and that was Reticulum, but they came from different planets than one of the sun systems there, and they were not exactly the same species.
I had a fellow on in Loughlin who insists that he's been able to witness with special night vision goggles Star Wars-type activity going on. Have you run across, is there any battles going on out of there, or are they all enlightened at this point?
You know, I don't I don't know of any battles that are going on out there, but I am convinced in my own mind that we have scores of Earth-made flying discs made in the United States that can take off from their underground bases, go into orbit, and stay as long as their food supplies last, and come back under their own power and land in their underground bases again.
So in other words, you don't find it stretching the imagination at all when we talk about a secret space force going on right now.
No, I think we have squadrons.
You're an old Air Force guy. How do you keep that quiet? If I went to space and went around to a base on the moon or Mars or someplace, I'd have to tell somebody. I guess that's the reason I'm not doing it.
They tell me that there is a special academy out in the Colorado Springs area that when all of the plebes for the Air Force Academy arrive, they're screened for new plebes that have short family connections. They are either foster children, orphans.
And we talked about that with the Serpo story. These 12 that they chose, or 10, or ever how many there were, that they didn't have families.
Well, that's true. But people that work in the space program, flying discs, are chosen the same way, so they have no tight family connections. And when they accept a commission into that society, they don't change jobs like other officers do. They stay in the same job for the whole career, and when they retire, they just take off their uniform and go back to work in civilian clothes. Can't leave. They can only leave those facilities together or with others, like watching each other. And the perks are such that they're paid so well, and they have the best of all available.
So they have some sort of additional bonus system where it's
great.
Worthwhile.
The best food, the best entertainment, the best everything in their underground facilities. There's nothing better that they can get when they get out of there. They've paid well, and they have nice bank accounts and everything. If they defect, they lose their perks, and they probably are not going to live very long. And so they all know this. They're not going to break the rules.
And we talked in Laughlin, a harrowing story about a couple of people getting knocked off investigating things. So you have no doubt that it's a pretty dangerous job if you go investigate a UFO or start talking about it.
Yes, and I had one of our...
I'm talking about up in New Mexico. Remember that Holloman...
I had a Marine sentry from level 2 of S4 come to me one time. He told me that after his quarterly annual physical examination, they called him in a couple of days later and told him that he was dying of a fatal disease, and they were going to discharge him from the service and send him home so he could straighten out his affairs before he perished. They told him he had less than 2 weeks to live. Well, he knew if he had a disease, he's living internally on level 2 of S4 that's perfectly sanitary, not exposed to anything, that if he has a fatal disease, they have given it to him, his superiors, because all of the sentries there were used as government assassins. They don't call them assassinations, they call them missions. But those special forces troops like that are recruited at a very young age, on 17 or 18, where they're very impressionable. And they go through training exercises that make them weep when the flag goes up and down the flagpole. They're so patriotic. And they're prepared. They told and reminded all along that they're job, there's an elite force, their job is to take care of the enemies of the American government. So they learn to believe their superiors implicitly. If anybody is characterized as an enemy of the American government and it's their job to take him out, they don't hesitate. Even if it would be their mother or a brother, they wouldn't hesitate. So that's that kind of training they had. Now, they call those operations special operations. They get $5,000 each for one. And they don't consider it murder. I consider an execution like that a murder. And this guy had done 18 of them. And I told him, don't you think you might be getting vulnerable about now? You know too much about everything. You're becoming a liability, not an asset anymore. And he says, yes, I think that's what's happened. He says, I think they have come to that conclusion, too, and they have given me this disease. I said, well, let's go to a doctor and get it checked to see what we can do about it. He says, I don't want to know about it. If I'm going to go, I don't want to be waiting to die. He says, I don't want to know, but I'm going to bring their house of cards down if I can before I go. And he started giving me information on what was happening at level 2 of S4.
And do you know what happened to him? Did he die?
They finally killed him, yes.
Did he die right away? Or?
He didn't die right away. He lived for another month or so before I lost track of him.
And what kind of stuff did he tell you?
Well, he was going to take a shower, and he took his the stuff out of his pockets and put it on my coffee table in my living room. Then he went to take a shower, and I knew he was going to be in there for 5 minutes or more. So he laid his wallet on the table. He'd been giving me a name, that his name was Connor O'Ryan. So I thought, oh, let's look in there and see what his name is. And I looked in his wallet, and his name was not Connor O'Ryan. Mm-hmm. That was a false name he was using. His real name was Derek Hennessy. And he had it folded in. He told me that he had good business cards, good credit cards. And he had Diners Club, and he had American Express, and all the good cards. And he told me that he had $300,000 in the bank, but he couldn't draw any out after he left. His banks were, his accounts were all frozen. And he feared the worst. So I also found, folded up tight in between the cards, was a W-4. You know what that is? That's a withholding statement.
Right.
A W-4 from his employer, the Central Intelligence Agency at Langley Field. He had a Central Intelligence number. He had a Central Intelligence code name. He was drawing $72,000 a year from Central Intelligence in addition to his Marine pay. And so I know that we have people like that. And he had just, there was also a copy of his last hit in there, and it was an American Green Beret, Army Green Beret in Budapest, Hungary. He left his level 2 position in S4 out in Nevada there, took an airline down to Los Angeles, all tickets provided by the government, another ticket to take him to Budapest. He was met at Budapest by the American Embassy staff car, picked up at the airport and driven to the American Embassy, where they took his American clothes away and gave him Hungarian clothes, Hungarian shoes, Hungarian pistol with Hungarian bullets in it, a key to an apartment rented in a Hungarian name, and told him that he was being paired with another Special Force troop to carry out this hit. They had something like 4 days to carry out the hit and leave. And there was also, he was given a picture profiled and side view of the hit, where he lived, the routes he took to and from church, to his grocery store, to his work and back, and where the kids went to school. And together they shot him to death coming out of a grocery store in front of his teenage kids in the car.
And they caught the airplane and went home.
And yeah, they just disappeared and just blended with the crowd, walked back to the American Embassy. Why, they took up their pistol and clothes.
You know who this fellow was that they knocked off? I mean, was he an important
person?
I
don't know. He was an American Senior Master Sergeant Green Beret, Army Green Beret. So he told me that he had carried out a special mission just a few weeks before that. And I said, don't you think that's making you vulnerable? He said, I think so. He said, I know that I have eliminated a few others that I had doubts about, but my superiors had the information. They characterized him to me. They know. And so I believe that he would accept whatever his superiors told him as gospel fact. He would carry out the hit with no remorse. He doesn't feel bad about it. He's eliminating an enemy of the American government, which he's trained to do. And they don't call them assassinations at all. I think it's strictly government assassination.
I shouldn't be doing this on your radio. Ask you what I thought about the secret government. That story is even more revealing. They got a lot of people doing a lot of dirty things, huh?
Well, we shouldn't be talking about that on the radio.
Wendell, thanks very much for coming by. Our time's up on this thing. You're going to just keep on going, right?
Maybe not after this.
Well, hey, don't make me lay awake at night. I appreciate the story, though, but maybe there's something about telling things in public. Maybe we'll be okay, both of us.
Well, I don't know.
Have you had any threats recently? I know you have.
No, I used to get death threats. I haven't had any recently. Maybe get some now.
Well, okay, you heard it from Wendell Stevens. We'll keep an eye open.
Yeah.
We'll be reading the papers.
Yeah.
Good luck, Wendell.
Okay,
thanks
you.
Very much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Jerry.
It's Jerry Pippin. We're broadcasting from the Ozark Conference.